The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets take a breather. Oil surges on an OPEC deal. And the EU is watching and waiting for what's going to be with the Italian referendum. Our guest today, Jack Vogel, PhD, author of Quantitative Momentum, a practitioner's guide to building a momentum-based stock selection system. All this and much more on episode number 487 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, welcome. Andrew Horowitz here, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the first week of December 2016, coming down the final stretch, home stretch of the year with some very interesting things that have been tracking throughout the time. Of course, we know that we saw this incredible rally that was not supposed to be the case after Donald Trump was elected president, but because of all of the potential for stimulus in the form of fiscal spending, tax cuts, possible repatriation of foreign assets by companies here in the U.S. into the U.S. in the hundreds of billions of dollars. The idea is that, wow, this is going to be some good times coming. So here we are, and we did see that this week the rally that was really pretty strong, especially for small caps and across the board for U.S., for the U.S. dollar, seemed to sputter and lose a little bit of its upward momentum. And we did see 2 weeks of up markets for the prior 2 weeks. This was a down week. We saw the NASDAQ get crushed pretty well. As a matter of fact, the NASDAQ got hurt really, I think it was on Thursday that the NASDAQ came down pretty hard. Wednesday, it wasn't looking so good. Friday, you know, it tried its best to recover some of that, but something's going on and may be due to the fact that there is this question as to how much it's going to hurt the multinationals, particularly technology companies, if in fact, number one, the U.S. dollar continues to be at these high levels. It's not just a short-term quick up and then back down to normal. Rates increasing, the buybacks that have been done due to low interest rates, buying back shares on the issuance of fixed income. And then on top of that, the question about repatriation and what's going to happen there. So there's a lot of moving parts right now in this whole dynamic of what we're seeing in the markets. And that is obviously causing some consternation in the eyes of investors that are concerned about whether or not this is a sustainable rally. Now, I did mention also, if you remember, a couple of things. I mentioned that last week that seasonality reports that I did and research that I did lended itself to showing that the next couple of weeks into probably about close to the second week of December lend itself to a weaker market environment, especially post-election in an election cycle. Now, that doesn't always play out exactly with, okay, well, here you go. We're going to see an up move and then a down move and then an up move, and you can kind of mark your calendars to any particular day. But it does, a lot of times the seasonality reports and research that we do lend itself to a pretty good level of at least, well, it's not going to be extremely strong during this general period. Now, the only negative to this report that I would say and the question that I would have is it seems to be, even though it's relatively reliable over a certain period, the question is the period too tight to really look at this as something that you can actively invest with? In other words, we're talking about a seasonality that looks at the post-election period through the end of November as being strong, and then the beginning of December until about 2 weeks into December as being weak. And then you have all of a sudden the end of year, we'll call it the Santa Claus rally, the end of year rally. One of the things you have to know right now is that there's a lot of moving parts, as I mentioned. And one of the big issues right now is what's going to happen towards the end of this year, considering the fact that there may be, at least it's scheduled to be, some kind of tax relief that may be in the cards for 2017 and forward? And if that's the case, think about this. Would you actually go and look to gather your capital gains right now and roll them till next year? Now, what you may want to do is, in fact, start taking out your losers right now. Hold on to your gainers and take out the losers that may be somewhere hurting your portfolio, because you get a better tax deduction this year as rates are higher than you would next year. So possibly some of the weak stocks that have been going on this year, and maybe some of the technology that's starting to roll over right now, possibly some of them, it could be related to that. But generally speaking, most are going to be thinking about taking their gains next year because of the potential for a capital gains tax reduction and tax reduction overall. That could have something to do with it. But again, this is a pretty tight area here, and I just don't know, with a new administration coming in with a similar, with, you know, Republicans being both in the presidency and Congress now, I'm not quite sure if that seasonality is going to hold up as well as you would think. And what I mean by that is, not necessarily are we going to see this move up like we saw. That worked out fine. And the move down is starting to work out fine also. I just don't know what's going to happen towards the end of the year this year, because I think there are other circumstances that will be considered. Let's talk a little bit for a second about some of the things that are happening with regard to the economy. Now, with regard to the jobs report, we saw the final jobs report for 2016 last Friday, and the rate fell to a 9-year low in November at 4.6%. We saw that 178,000 new jobs were added. Now, why did it drop from 4.9% to 4.6%? That's a pretty substantial drop. Well, a lot of it had to do with the fact that there was a significant move in the amount of people who were in or were out of the job force. In other words, the labor participation rate once again dropped down. Therefore, when you look at the calculation, the statistics behind all of this, it showed that there was a lot fewer people in the workforce. Therefore, when you do the calculation of the amount of people that were actually actively working, et cetera, well, it looked a lot better. So we went down to 4.6%. So that was a headline. We saw 178,000 new jobs added. That was a good number. That's nothing wrong with that. The U6 number, which is the underemployed, decreased to about 9.3%. That's also a good number. Now, there was some negative news in this, and nothing really major, but the yearly and the annual wage growth was at 2.5%. And the high level of retirements that are starting to come in right now from the baby boomer generation is starting to really throw the labor participation rate off. So, you know, in total, you could say that this report, not to be kind of, you know, on both sides of the aisle here, but there was a little bit of everything in this report for everyone. If you're, you know, on the bullish side of things and saying the economy is really good, you can point to the fact that we have 4.6% unemployment rate. That's good. If on the other hand, you want to say, well, you know, yeah, that's good, but the truth of the matter is that it's really a statistical anomaly. That's what's really causing this. So I think you go both ways, and that's why the market pretty much didn't go anywhere. Now, we did see that there was a strong consumer confidence number. The Conference Board's monthly consumer confidence index rose to about 6.3, rose about 6.3 to 107.1, which was pretty good. 107.1 is pretty substantial, especially that this was before the election. Now, personal spending also increased a small amount, 0.3%. Personal income was up 0.6%. That's good. And we did see, of course, the one thing that was really interesting was that we saw a revision to the GDP, the gross domestic product, upward revision to 3.2%. So there we are. Everybody complaining that we're in a 1 to 2% GDP number. All of a sudden, here we are at 3.2 with a good jobs number. What does that mean? Inflation starting to tick up? Well, we could go all the way to the end of the process here and say, there's probably a pretty high probability that the Fed is definitely on their December 14th meeting going to raise at least the minimum amount. There's no more excuses left. Maybe they'll throw out something about the world. We'll see what happens with Italy over the weekend. There's some other elections and votes happening around the world on various different items as well. The dollar being very strong may be something they're very concerned about. But at this point, really, seriously, there's not much more that the Fed can pull out of their tuchuses to say why, well, we're really concerned about this or that. And, you know, we got to hold off for a little while. They're at the end of their usefulness at this point with keeping rates as low as they are, because really with GDP increasing as it is without any fiscal stimulus, and with the outlook being that there's going to be some tax cuts and there's going to be some additional fiscal stimulus in the form of infrastructure spending, all the things that come into play here, I think it's pretty much a slam dunk here. We're at about a 98% probability on Fed funds futures that there's going to be a rate hike. And you add the final unemployment rate number that we saw, really, they're at their dual mandate has been met. We saw the pending home sales and home prices were shown to see some gains. The Case-Shiller 20-city index that we look at on a regular basis showed a 5.5% year-over-year gain, which was up from about 5.2, I think it was, last month. Now, housing contract activity added a little bit in October, so that was good. So generally speaking, the housing market continues to heal and do well. We also saw that the manufacturing index, which was the ISM, rose to about 53.2. Remember, that was teetering on a questionable area that looked like it could be starting to drag under 50 for some time, and all of a sudden it started to pop up pretty nicely. So there was more expansion once again. It was a little bit slightly lower than expectations, but still, you know, depending on which particular analyst you look at, but let's just call it, it was pretty much on the mark. So manufacturing gains are picking up. We see the regionals are picking up. The beige book was actually showing moderate growth overall. And when you add up all the other things we talked about, once again, the economy does look pretty good. If nothing else, it looks at least reasonably solid. And finally, I guess one of the things we have to discuss is what's going on with oil. It's kind of humorous, actually, because OPEC did come to an agreement that they're going to cut production. What's humorous about it is that they ramped up production over the last few months only to just come back and simply say, we're going to, you know, cut this and hold production at these levels, take some offline. But it's only the amount they ramped up over the last couple of months. It's kind of like going into a store and buying an item on sale that was recently increased in price. So you got something that was $10, it went up to $12, and now they're giving you a 20% discount. Not much of a difference there. It feels better. We got a discount on this. But the truth of the matter is OPEC's really not doing much. Nonetheless, we saw that oil futures ended up at 51.68, up a whopping 12% for the week. Pretty impressive. And we saw that the Dow Jones was the one holdout. It did actually rise 0.1% for the week. S&P dropped about 1%. And the NASDAQ was down 2.5% for the week. The Russell was also, the small caps were down 2.5% after that glorious rally. That rally since the election, it was up like 15 days in a row before all of a sudden things started turning over a little bit. And it was up, I guess, about 12% at one point since the election. Now, coming out this week, let's talk about this very briefly. We have the November non-manufacturing or the service sector ISM number coming out on Monday. Earnings also from companies like AutoZone, Bob Evans, Dave & Buster's, and Michael Stores. We're going to start seeing some of the numbers out of the home builders this week as well. Toll Brothers arriving on Tuesday. We're going to see factory sales, factory orders on Tuesday as well. Then coming up on Wednesday, we have H&R Block, Lululemon, Athletica. And on Thursday, we're going to have the latest report on jobless claims. Broadcom, Dell, Hovnanian, and Toro. And Friday, we're going to see the University of Michigan index of sentiment as well. So we have a lot happening this week. Not, you know, we're at the tail end of most earnings. The economics are coming in ever so slowly now. It's not a big week for economics, but there's going to be, I would say, a pretty good anticipation for what's going on in Europe. And then in particular, it looks like Mario Draghi, I think on Thursday, I believe it's Thursday, he's making a statement as to whether or not he's going to increase, decrease, keep, or whatever he's going to do with his bond buying program. And a lot of that is going to be contingent, I believe, on what's happening in Italy with the referendum that they're looking to vote on and deal with on Sunday, which is today. And then we have, of course, the Fed coming out on the 14th of December. So there's going to be, I think, a lot of anticipation into that. Already we see the dollar has rolled over a bit, which is pretty interesting. Bonds that were dropping like crazy on, and the yield spreads increasing, which was very, very good for banks for, post-election. Starting to pull back a little bit already. And that's, again, ahead of, I think, some squaring off ahead of the potential for the Fed to make a statement of whatever they're going to make. I still think they're going to be relatively dovish, but we'll see how it goes. I mean, they just can't get themselves out of that dovish mode. All right, let's take a break from the economics. I'll mention right now, if you want to find out more information about what we do here, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's all sorts of things there that you can find in terms of the other podcasts like DH Unplugged, what we do, the notes from this episode and other episodes. You can do a podcast search, ask me questions. If you like what we're doing here, if you like what we say, some of the concepts we talk about in terms of investing, several different strategies available for you over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Go check it out and you can find out more. And our guest today is Jack Vogel, PhD. We got a smart one with us today. He is the CIO and CFO of Alpha Architect, an asset management firm delivering affordable, active exposures for tax-sensitive investors. Also co-author of a couple of books. His latest one is called Quantitative Momentum, a practitioner's guide to building a momentum-based stock selection system. So good day to you, Jack. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So let's kind of start from the basics. You know, your book is entitled Quantitative Momentum. So what I get out of that is some kind of a screening process or something to non-emotionally pull up what could be momentum-based opportunities. But let's kind of get down to brass tacks and explain to me and explain to everybody in the audience, what's momentum? What does that mean?
Yeah, so momentum, and the way we think of it in a stock selection framework is, simply can be measured as like the total return of a security over some look back period. And I'll just give you a simple example. So imagine we have stock A that was worth $10 a year ago, and it's worth $15 today. So we would say that stock A is up 50%, mm-hmm. while stock B, was worth $10 a year ago, and it's worth $5 today. So that is down 50%. So momentum and how we measure it would be simply your total return over the past year. Other companies, investors like to use different time periods like 3, 6, 9 months. They all kind of end up being around the same. So we use the past year total return. And a momentum investing strategy is one where you invest more in securities that have had prior higher returns. So in my simple example of stock A and B, you would invest in stock A that's up 50%, and you would not invest in stock B, which was down 50%.
So that flies to the total opposite of what, or I guess maybe you can even say this, that momentum investing is the antithesis of value investing. Would that be somewhat true?
I think that's a fair, what I'd say is they're different in that, momentum investing, it's you're true. You're buying stocks that are have had previous good returns over the past year, whereas value stocks, you're buying returns that are cheap. The one difference is momentum is purely based on a return signal, whereas value investing, it's based on an accounting measure as well. So it's not they are opposites, but they're measured slightly differently.
So now when I look at the whole idea of momentum investing, And we're looking at returns, right, as you mentioned. And so let's say that we look at a one-year basis and stock has a 50. The top stock in this list of stocks is a 50% return. Mm-hmm. And then it goes down from there, let's say. Now, what you're saying is you may not look at even before that, the year before that. So it could be that this stock has been on fire for a while, possibly. And the question then is, I guess, how do you know when that's no longer a momentum stock? Because a lot of times these Momo stocks, as I call them, as many people call them, the Momos, are, you know, when they stop working, they not only stop working, but they stop working in a big way.
Yeah, and that's a great point that you bring up. Momentum investing, to be done properly, needs to be done in a systematic fashion. Because as you point out, momentum stocks, the whole idea is that, you know, firms with prior higher returns than other stocks have this continuation of returns. But it's been shown in research in numerous places that at some point, momentum stocks become just like any other stock. So in general, you need to do it in a systematic fashion. And the more frequent you rebalance, the better. We have settled upon a quarterly rebalance, meaning every quarter we assess what are the top momentum stocks. And then, if a stock is in the portfolio and is still considered high momentum, we'll keep it. But if not, we will sell it and replace it with another security.
So now what universe do you start with?
So for US-based stocks, we basically look at, all mid large cap stocks that are liquid, that are, not, we'll exclude like REITs and ETFs, but basically just common stocks within the US that have data and are large enough and liquid. So it's about, we do $2 billion and above, just ballpark, mm-hmm. with a liquidity screen.
So now, again, we have this momentum situation where we look back each quarter for this, and you can use a variety of different screening process. I mean, a FinViz for those people that maybe don't have a paid-for screener with Bloomberg or Thomson or wherever else that you get mm-hmm. your screeners from. You could, look at this and find those that are really doing well in terms of that. But so really what we're looking at is no fundamentals really to speak of here, right?
Exactly.
So it's just moving. Now, it's moving in the direction we want it to move. And so we'll just continue on and just kind of, as Howard Lindzen would say, when it comes to momentum, is kind of ride the wave until it throws you off.
Yeah, that's a very accurate assessment.
Yeah. So how is that different from a trend issue? So you have trends, which is kind of closely, I guess trends can be different because it doesn't necessarily tell you about performance. But let me back up one second before I even ask this. So back to the screening process. So you find stocks, and let's say the top stock, again, is up 50% over the last year. Let's take a different scenario. Let's say that you can include the top 20 stocks, just as a number. Top 20 yep. stocks that are in the momentum screen, we're going to buy. Okay, fine. What if that entire screen is negative? Do you still buy the best stocks? Because the momentum is the opposite way, right? The momentum is actually down. How do you deal with that?
That's a good question. So, and one thing, as you point out, in general, we would probably never recommend to invest in one stock. You want to have a diversified, 30, 40, 50 stock portfolio of momentum stocks due to the fact that, you just want to minimize idiosyncratic risk where you can for free. So that's first thing. Now, Your question was, what happens if all of them are negative? Mm-hmm. Now, actually, I have a blog post on this. Historically, on average, the highest momentum buckets around like 60% return over the past year, and those negative returns only really happen in, it's very small time periods, i.e., like 2009, March 2009 mm-hmm. after everything had blown up. But we would. The way we run our strategy, we would still continue actually to buy the bucket of these momentum securities. Now, and that's again using momentum as a stock selection tool. Now, you had kind of mentioned and then went back on, and we're talking about a trend rule.
Yeah.
Let's say everything is below zero. A trend rule is, and some people will call that like time series momentum, where you look at the momentum of each security over the past year, and you would only invest if it is positive. And trend rules on average can be beneficial to a portfolio for minimizing drawdowns. And again, they're not perfect, but if you were using a trend rule on top of a stock selection rule, you may not invest if it's below zero.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. So now, there's a variety of areas in your book. You know, you talk about in chapter or part two, I should say is building a momentum based stock selection model, which is kind of what we're talking about here. And looking at short-term momentum of page 81, short-term momentum of 1 to 1 month look back, a 60-month look back, a 12-month look back. And then you gave a lot of examples of how to look at generic momentum overall, and then what happens with long-term, and you know, give a lot of statistics on things and talking about a variety of functionalities of how they on how they actually play out and what happens. You probably are, I would think, a fan of, it's not ringing a bell. James O'Shaughnessy.
Yeah.
You're probably a big fan of him because he does all quant work. I mean, his books are, you know, the masterpiece in the industry, right? Let's be honest.
Yeah.
So you do a lot of look backs and that. And then we talked about the difference between value, where it's some fundamentals and looking for cheap stocks, maybe low PEs, low price to book, you know, a variety of different factors, maybe even looking at, let's look at an industry sector and then saying, okay, well, which one is the cheapest compared to all the rest? Which one hasn't performed compared to all the rest and it should, and et cetera, and looking for maybe reversionary types of characteristics. But now let's talk about the difference between growth and momentum.
Yeah. So what I'd say is that there is definitely a confusion, because let me just describe momentum again. You know, momentum investing involves buying stocks that have had high returns over the past year, while growth investing involves buying stocks that have a high price relative to some accounting number, such as earnings, right? So that's how we get the P/E ratio. So, you know, these definitions definitely sound similar. Both of them are buying something that's high over the past year, right? Momentum is high return. Whereas growth investing is a high price relative to some accounting measure. And so while the definitions sound similar, they're definitely not the same. And, you know, just looking after the fact at what happened, if you were a momentum investor, you know, and you can get all the data from Ken French's website, you know, but if you were a momentum investor since 1927, when his data starts, you know, before transaction costs, you would have had a higher return above the market. Whereas if you were a growth investor, i.e. buying high PE stocks since 1927, you would have underperformed the market, you know, for a, what would it be here, almost 80-year run, or actually almost 90-year run, right? So while the two sound the same, there's definitely not the same. And in our book, we highlight that the overlap between the portfolios is only like 29%. So, you know, growth investing, the way it's defined now, has, you know, a small overlap with momentum investing. And while they sound the same, they're definitely not the same.
And as my friend Brian Channon would say, only price pays. And that's the whole mantra of momentum investing, is it's all about price. It's all about movement. Right.
Pretty much. And you did highlight, just to go back on something you had talked about previously, momentum investing. You know, when people talk about it and they use this continuation of returns, it is important that you use intermediate term momentum, you know, 3 to 12 months look back period. Because as you highlighted, if you do a longer term momentum look back, like 5 years, that actually, you know, high momentum firms over 5 years actually mean revert. Which is kind of actually a values type strategy. So it is important to understand, you know, if you're going to do a momentum strategy, you use an intermediate term look back from somewhere from like 3 to 15 months.
Okay. Now, I think the best way, I'm getting a picture in my head here of something, or maybe a metaphor, if you will. I'm thinking of cars. I'm thinking of cars on a racetrack. And I'm thinking that the momentum is you're betting on the car that is consistently, you know, as you've been watching all of this play out here, consistently running it top notch, way ahead of the pack, lapping everybody else. Whereas growth investing is, well, I know that car's got the potential. I know that car's got the power. It just hasn't kicked in yet. And value is, you know what? Well, maybe the guy just blew a tire. And now they're going to replace the tires and do a few things and possibly, you know, kick some butt moving forward. And then value stocks, by the way, can become momentum stocks. There's no reason why they can't, of course, you know, and because they're all different. One is dealing with growth and value investing. Tell me if I'm wrong about this, but growth investing and value investing is, well, that's based on fundamentals primarily, whereas momentum is based on price, but yet the growth and the value can become momentum based over time. So actually kind of a good combo if you can kind of string some of those all together, I assume.
Yeah. I mean, if you just look at the data, that one of the pure benefits and a reason, actually, when we wrote the book Quant Momentum, Wes and I both came from a background of value investing. You know, our first strategy our company really ran was a value-based strategy. We still do that. We're, you know, Bible thumping value investors. But we kind of actually wanted to write the book from the context of a value investor, where we wanted to explain that momentum investing and having that as a part of a portfolio, as you point out, can be very beneficial. And just historically, if you look, you know, if you take out the market and just look at a value strategy, which is where you buy the cheap stocks, short the expensive stocks, and run a correlation of that strategy to, you know, a momentum strategy where you buy the high momentum stocks, short the low momentum stocks. And again, in real world, you don't short, but this is just to take out the market. But the value and momentum strategy actually historically have a negative correlation in a long short strategy, which means that essentially when one does well, the other performs poorly. And, you know, from a long only investor, what's an example? Well, in the internet run up, momentum investing was a great strategy. In the internet crash, value investing was a great strategy. So the way we like to think of it is it's almost impossible, to be honest, to say when momentum is going to do better than value, when value is going to do better than momentum. But we know historically they've been good trades, so we're just going to do both of them because they seem to work at different times.
Just to hit you a little bit over the head on something, you mentioned, in real life we don't short. In real life, maybe you don't short, you're saying, but there is the potential to do so.
Oh, yeah. And that's definitely true. A lot of people do short. That's true. I'm just saying for the majority of investors who are just looking for a long only factor bet, such as like value momentum, they may not take a long short strategy as part of the portfolio.
So now how for an investor, for an average guy out there, or average gal out there that doesn't have all the software in order to, it doesn't pay $25,000 to Bloomberg a year and maybe $25,000 to Thompson's or whatever it is. Have you identified where there's some good screening, quantitative screening places to do this? Or is it something you could do in Excel very easily? Or how do you do this?
Yeah, so a couple things. One thing is, our firm mission is to kind of like empower through education. So we actually offer some free tools on our website that just give basic screens on value and momentum, i.e. past year's returns, as well as, we like enterprise multiples for value. So we offer that on our website. Some other neat websites I've seen, one is like Portfolio 123. I think they have a pretty good little screening tool. We give it away for free on ours. Portfolio 123 is pretty good. And with momentum investing specifically, if you have a little bit of computer ability, you can kind of maybe scrape some data from Yahoo Finance and basically, it's just past 1 year return. So you can do that in Excel pretty easily if you have the data.
Actually, it would seem to me that, either Yahoo, actually, I'll tell you where you could probably do it now that I'm thinking about it. I bet you very easily, because we've done these in a different manner, but you could probably use Google spreadsheets or Google Sheets or whatever they call them. To bring in, and I know you can do this, bring in Google Finance data right into the, I don't know if you've ever done this before, I'm not sure, but you could bring the Google Finance data right into a cell. Now, whether it's going to be return information exactly as you want to see it, you probably look at 1 year, you could look at a certain return period, and then probably do a rank and sort kind of process.
Yeah, That would definitely work. Again, for momentum, you just you definitely can do it because it's, you know, the data is, it's just total return. So,
but it's gonna be more complicated than that. I mean, your book is 200 pages. Let's call it. So, oops, just dropped the book. 200 pages. Getting called quantitative momentum, but it's got to be more than just simply looking at. I mean, is it can it be just as simple as looking at, you know, what's performed over the last 12 months, and then also maybe doing a little bit of so what's performed in the last 12 months, but then also double ranking it and sorting it with what's, let's say, doing the last 3 months, as you mentioned, to see what's the, you know, kind of like an exponential moving average, right? Weighting the near-term returns higher than the longer-term returns.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, yeah, we wrote a much bigger book on it. Then part of the second half of the book is like, hey, okay, basic momentum investing is we're just going to buy stocks with whoever had the best past 1 year return. Now, clearly, is there a better way to do that? You know, there are some ways. The one way we use in the book and how we implement in real life is we kind of look at it's actually called frog in the pan measure, and the whole idea, it's a really cool paper with a neat title. It's called Frog in the Pan. Basically, you know, if you put a frog into a pan with boiling water, the frog's going to jump right out. But if you put a frog into a pan with cold water and then slowly heat it up, unfortunately, the frog will stay in until the end.
Yeah, soup. We call it frog soup, by the way.
Yeah, frog soup. So the whole idea with this is basically there's a research question, which is, let's say we have two momentum stocks. We have, you know, boring big box, which is up, you know, 50 basis points over the past 200 days. So it's up 100%. So every day it just kind of grinds out and no one pays attention to it because it's, you know, called boring big box. Whereas we have another stock called, you know, exciting biotech. And, you know, basically exciting biotech's grinding along around zero. And then, you know, 2 days before it gets an FDA approval and it's up 100%. So in this example, these are both high momentum stocks, up 100%. The question, and empirically, is what happens in the future? Should we try to focus our momentum-based strategy on the boring firms, boring big box, or should we look for and invest in these exciting firms? And the evidence shows that you'd be better off as an investor investing in the boring big box store. So we talk about that in our book. But as you mentioned, you know, a simple way, because the frog in the pan measure, you need like daily returns. A back of the book simple way to do it would be something like you mentioned with exponential moving average, or just doing like a low vol screen within high momentum. And that can add some value to your portfolio.
So let me tell you a recent screen that we did, and I mentioned it on the show. It is much more. This is way outside the box in terms of anything that is probably a screen quantitative analysis process that you can use for building a portfolio. But you probably noticed over the last few weeks there's been a good amount of very active stocks doing some very peculiar things. For example, we had companies in the whole bulk shipping area, right? Have you seen any of these? Have you been watching these?
I'll admit we do a lot of quantitative stuff, so I'm not as digging in on day to day, but I do pay attention.
So these things are up. I mean, one of them, Dry Ships, was up from $5 to $115 in a week, which is absurd. Because even if somebody was looking to take out this company and buy it, they're not buying it for $115 when the stock was at $5. It's not happening, okay? There's a Globus Maritime. There's a whole selection. I was watching all these. I'm like, geez, what's going on with these stocks? And my listeners have heard this story before. This is only last week or so. So I started to look at this. What is it that these stocks have in common? And I'll tell you what we found. Number one, we found that they've done a recent reverse split in the neighborhood of, you know, 10 to 15 to 1. Reverse split. Yeah. They have low float outstanding, so low shares outstanding to the public, limited, I should say. Their volume is, you know, somewhere, it can be in a variety of places, but, you know, volume we kind of put on there too. And we looked at short interest to float was very high, 25, 30%. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we created this kind of screen, again, quantitative screen. We created the screen and we found, I don't know, 30 different stocks on there. Okay. Some of them don't have a lot of volume, but the main thing was looking for the reverse split with limited amount, I think under 2 million shares afloat with a high short interest. So you can imagine if something explodes on any of those, it's going to get crazy because this is, you know. And we put out that list. I mentioned to my listeners that they can grab that list of stocks over on the disciplineinvestor.com website. But I've been watching that list just for the fun, you know, kind of shits and giggles, if you will.
Yeah.
And, you know, every day there's kind of, there are some that are down, but every day there's like one or two of those that are just going bananas. Now, how to find that on a daily basis is a different discussion, right? But kind of that's the whole process of trying to find something. Now, this is not long-term. I can't test this because this is a unique, weird situation. You know, it's not something Jim O'Shaughnessy will put in his book.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's not something that we're going to, you know, you're going to run a portfolio based on. But anyway, kind of interesting situation. So are there, I guess, you know, when you look at momentum investing, again, you talked about as a part of a portfolio, an overall portfolio. What is there kind of a best, you know, kind of like a few things that you could say are, okay, you know, if you're going to do this, here's a few things you need to know. Here's the way you need to employ this best. Here's the way that, you know, maybe some caveats or some, what's the word I'm looking for here? Best practices.
Yeah. So so basically for momentum investing, as I mentioned earlier, probably rule number one is you need to do it systematic. Because, you know, if you just say, hey, every quarter we're going to rebalance into, you know, 30, 40, 50 stocks with the highest past 12-month momentum, that's probably the most important rule is it's got to be done systematically. I would take out all emotion and just kind of do it. Because as you've pointed out and we discussed, you know, momentum stocks, they do trail off at some point. But we think in 3-month time period for holding, you're okay. Rule number two is, you know, probably I wouldn't – in general, we like to have like, you know, 30 to 50 stocks in a portfolio. So, you know, I'd recommend that investors build a diversified set of these just to take out some of like the firm-specific risk. And I think you should be aware if you do a high concentration portfolio like I just mentioned, 30 to 50, that you're going to have some pretty long periods of potential underperformance. And again, that's just – you need to understand that's part of what you're doing. If you don't want to have underperformance and big underperformance for, you know, longer periods, well, then you have to start selecting more and more stocks, in which case you just become more and more like the market.
Well, by the way, I just like to – you know, you seem like a smart guy that's been doing this for a bit. And I think the whole notion of always – when I say always – we talk about benchmarking, we talk about comparative performance. This whole idea that has sprouted up over the last number of years of always comparing to the S&P 500 as an example is so ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree in that it's okay to compare, I think, just to see what one could have done. But you do have to understand. I mean, if you're following a model and you know ex ante, it's not going to work all the time. What's the point of comparing? So I do kind of agree with you there.
I mean, and if you want to compare it over a 5-year period, that's fine. But 1 year, 2 year, anything could happen in any circumstance. And it could be, by the way, that maybe the model outperformed and the S&P underperformed, if you understand what I'm saying, like underperformed historical norms. But the point is that you're also dealing with 500 stocks, and that's not a true benchmark. And if I tell people this all the time, if you want to be an S&P, if you want to be, you know, compared with the S&P 500, that's what your benchmark is, and that's for whatever reason that's been drilled in our heads and we've been kind of accustomed to that. Well, you know what? Just go and buy SPY and be done with it. Because otherwise you're going to be miserable a lot of times, especially, you know, in a momentum, you could have some really good outperformance and you can have some real significant underperformance.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, as we've seen recently with like the rise of factors and factor-based ETFs, like smart beta type stuff, it's just a different investment strategy, but it's not going to work all the time. Like low volatility worked well over the past
couple of years. What a joke that was. Come on. You see it recently? Got smacked.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, just looking at the data, low vol's actually historically has been a decent bet because it's been a proxy for value. But if you've looked, when low volatility strategies get very expensive, which is what they are now, historically they've done worse in the future than the market. So, but it is what it is. You know, each factor is going to have its time, but it is very, I always say this, you know, individual investors are historically been shown to not be good at timing when to get in and out of stocks. So what leads us to believe that they're going to be great at timing factors? You know, probably little evidence. So we're fans of factor-based investing. We just think it's tough to decide, you know, when which factor is going to outperform.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, we're going to end it there. Lots of information there. Jack Vogel, PhD, author of Quantitative Momentum, a practitioner's guide to building a momentum-based stock selection system. And we'll have this information as well as how to contact Jack, et cetera, and find out more about what's going on there. You know, I just looked at the back of your book. I didn't see this before, but you got Pat O'Shaughnessy. Isn't that his son?
Yeah. Cool. We talked to Pat a lot. And I met Jim briefly the other day, but Jim knows Jim knows Wes, our founder as well.
Jim's been on my show a couple times, I believe it was. Really nice guy. All right. Hey, listen, thanks for joining us again. All the information will be on thedisciplinedinvestor.com on the notes of this particular episode. You can grab all that so you can find out, you know, where to get the book. And you can see Jack's smiley face on there and see what he looks like. Put the voice to the actual picture. So, Jack, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
Well, some great stuff there. And I encourage you, by the way, to think about one of the things that we discussed on the show was making your own momentum-based selection criteria. You could do that right on, as we mentioned, on like a Google Sheets where you can have an auto sort feature. You can put a list of stocks on there, and you can have the stocks coming up with the particular 1 month, 3 month, 6 month, 12 month, 2 year criteria of who is and which stock is actually performing best from a momentum standpoint, to give you just one more tool, one more way to look at, you know, what it is that is actually doing well in the markets, and if in fact there is something to be looked at. And you can even look at things called relative strength. You can compare, for example, the performance of the, let's say, the particular stocks that you're looking at to the S&P 500, or maybe even look at those stocks that are momentum-wise performing better than their sectors. So if you want to look at the banking sector, you could look at the banking ETF and see where that's been on a one-month, three-month, six-month basis. Put a list of the stocks that maybe are inside of that ETF. And then from there, what you could do is you can actually go in and see where the performance is and where the differentials are. Now, what you do from there is you can look at, on a shorter-term basis through a longer-term basis, which stocks inside that sector are actually performing better on a momentum basis, because we're dealing with price returns here. And then you could see what are the strongest for that particular sector, that particular area. So you could do that. That's kind of a cool way to do things also. Now, what you could also do one step beyond that, if you kind of really start expanding this whole notion of momentum trading and momentum screening and quantitative filtering for this, which is kind of a really cool thing to do, is stack up the various sectors of the S&P 500, the technology, the consumer staples, the consumer discretionary, the energy, et cetera, stack them all up against the S&P or SPY. You could use the ETS for this, and see where the momentum has been going in comparison. So what you do is you take the return, we'll do a relative strength here, we'll take the return on a one-month basis of, let's just say, the staples, okay, or the energy, or whatever particular sector we're looking at, okay, or the utility. So we look at XLU, we subtract out the S&P 500, we'll see how that's performing in the same period above or below, and we'll look at that compared to all the other ones, and where is the momentum, where is the actual trading benefit coming from a momentum-based structure. Again, it's just price-based, but if we're looking at that, we can do this in all sorts of ways on a comparative basis, and then look at which is the strongest sector, and then find out which are the strongest stocks inside the sector. So you look at the sectors, compare it to the S&P, you take the sector, you look at the stocks within it, compare it to those, and find where your momentum is. Another way to play it. So all sorts of ways to go. Anyway, we're going to end it right there. Thanks for joining me. Again, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out all the things that are available there. Check out all the different strategies that we have to offer. If it's time that maybe you think it's time to start looking at some of these. Thanks a lot for joining. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.